don't mind.
Okay, but I'm not going to backtrack and tell the part that's missing. You'll have to make your own notes of that. But I'll see if I can dig up a videotape I made where I gave like an hour actual presentation on this. If I come out to ASU and do this, maybe what we could do is take that for them. That would be a whole presentation.
The 8080 really couldn't do any kind of inline rendering?
Well, it couldn't do anything. You know, it's not that you couldn't do it. It's just that, you know, this the calculations, my estimates of the speed were just that it would be utterly unbearable.
So you calculated in advance.
It's pointless not to. Okay. And so I knew that wasn't going to cut it. Well, we had S100 bus machines where you plugged in the various components.
Yeah, we've got a lot of those.
And I found this guy up in Mill Valley who manufactured a little two-person business who manufactured a Texas Instruments 9900 processor. And this was a 16-bit processor, and it had hardware multiply and divide. It had a total of 64K of addressable space, okay, of which the operating system for it took 16. So I had 48K to work in. No problem. 48K I can handle. Okay. So I set about working on it, and decided that, you know, that wasn't one I was going to write in assembler, so I wrote a language, a high-level language that was very efficient, sort of a, in most ways, a predecessor of C++. Not C, I called it SPL, for Systems Programming Language, and it was unholy efficient. I'm seriously thinking of bringing it back, and even though it's a pointless thing, throwing it into the race again. And I proceeded to write a CAD program, and didn't like the first one, threw it away, wrote another one. The first one was an interpreter.
And was that running on an actual TI-99-4A, or what was it running, S100?
It was an S100 bus machine with a TI-9900 CPU and 16-bit wide memory.
Right.
That I figured could squeak by.
That would have been 1979, 80
or something. I started about 77, but about 79 it was working. Mm-hmm. Okay. Problem was, about 79, I had more entities than I could fit the code for in memory. Oh. Okay, so I would link it and throw some in, get them working, take them out, throw others in. Because my view was that, you know, I had to learn to do this and get it working, and that there would come along more powerful machines. I'm a firm believer in Moore's Law, and I have not been let down. I said, I have a goal. My goal is to be able to render photorealistic, picture-perfect scenes from full floating-point geometric models of reasonable complexity in a 1/30th of a second. When I hit that goal, performance beyond that no longer matters. That's not exactly true, but that was the goal, because that's the enabler.
That's the enabler, yeah.
And we're within about a year to 2 years of that right now. We're finally getting there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now you can do what I just said in a period of 3 to 4 seconds. Okay.
Wow.
So, you know, two more boings of the curve and I've got it. And they're moving up on it pretty fast.
So did you actually market the S100 system complete with the CAD on it, or did somebody do?
Yeah. I sold about 30 of them or something.
What did you call it?
Interact. And the guy who made the S100 bus card, the CPU card, was John Walker. And one day I took it up there to show him.
Right.
Okay. John was probably the smartest person I ever met. Okay, and he win all his arguments because he was fast.
Sure.
Sometimes he had logical flaws in him, but he was 2 or 3 steps ahead by the time he'd realized what was wrong with the one before. Okay, and I was just about fast enough to keep up with him, so I was probably the only known person to win an argument with him. Okay, and, you know, something that smart people are guilty of, myself included, is that we tend to explain to other people what's wrong with their point of view.
right.
Okay. Well, the thing is, it's not really that you're that egotistical, it's just that so often you get proven right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so you've got to watch for that becoming a mindset. Mm-hmm. So John was always fast off the block. And when I'm showing him this thing, for the first time ever, this guy's just totally quiet for 45 minutes. Like, ooh, he's not saying anything.
Wow.
Spooky.
Spooky.
Well, I get done, and the first thing he says, he says, you know what you have here? And I said, what? He says, a fortune. And I said, fine, show me how. And he did. And I became AutoCAD. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem was this. I set myself up for a problem in my initial agreement with him. Okay? I don't like lawyers with a whole lot of whereases, wherefores, and the clause of this and party of the 19th part kind of shit. Mm-hmm. So I write contracts in plain English. If a group of high school students can all agree with unanimous consent as to what it means, I figure it's going to hold up. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the original agreement between him and I, and it was a page and a half of just plain English. Okay? So it wasn't something somebody could really work their way out of. It was just too simple. But I was worried about two things, okay? The first was that they wouldn't go with it. They would set their dormant. I didn't want it to die.
Yeah, yeah.
So I maintained the right for me to independently go and sell a directly competing product. Mm-hmm. It was a non-exclusive license. And that they were to pay me 10% royalties of whatever they earned on it and on any products based on or derived from it. Because I when John and I were haggling over price, he wanted to pay me $8,000 and I wanted 15. You want to talk about one of the stupid decisions in the world? You should have paid me the 15 and let me walk with it. Mm-hmm. But instead, because see, he was worried that it wouldn't go anywhere. He didn't know it was
going
to
pay just that 15.
Yeah. No, he wouldn't pay me 15. Yeah. He thought that was too much.
Too much. You want to just pay it and walk away.
He wanted
away.
To pay me $8,000. Okay.
And as he bought it, that would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I asked for 15, and we couldn't reach an agreement. And his view was he didn't know that it would succeed or fail. And I says, mm-hmm. Okay, I'll take the risk. You don't pay me any money up front, and you give me 10% of whatever you make and whatever business it builds. Mm-hmm. That was one of the better deals of the century.
Absolutely. You'd be kicking yourself.
Okay. Yeah, I would have.
Yeah.
But at the time, I invented a guitar tuner, an electronic guitar tuner, with descendants all over the world, and I got $10,000 for it, because that's what I asked. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they tried to cheat me. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, really? Here's the check. You know.
So did you move out to Marin County?
No. I stayed here and hit. And what he did is he got him and a bunch of other programmers up there together, and we formed Autodesk, and it was going to be a software publishing house that would make many, many products, of which this, the main thing that this little interact thing was going to do was going to be to keep money rolling in while they wrote the really neat stuff.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, it's like riding a wild horse. It took off with a vengeance, mm-hmm. and...
So it got ported to what computer from the...
The next thing was the Vector 9000.
Oh, yeah. I'm still trying to find one of those.
Okay, this is an 8086 machine, yeah. Okay? And the problem was this. Right about the time we were doing this, see, I made this thing that I was going to be able to do independently. I could go sell it independently.
No.
John got very, very worried that meant that they were going to be doing lots of neat spiff stuff to the program. And I would be stealing it. So he decided that I would not be involved with the people doing the CAD. And they were going to port it from SPL to this brand new language, C. And the Lattice C compiler was shipping in beta at the time. Okay. And so my 48K program grew to 240K, the maximum memory that it would hold on a PC. And... when they got done with it, it was so phenomenally slow, I just could not stand it.
Yeah.
And I went, man, you killed another generation worth of Moore's Law right there. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the code the compiler was generating, and it was just abysmal. And, you know, remember, I had written the compiler.
Yeah.
You'd written
a language and then written a compiler.
What I was doing was giving the team some advice, you know, but having to do it sort of black box. And So not understanding the architecture, because John didn't want me to take and tutor them and explain it.
Yeah.
Okay. What they didn't understand, they ripped out, and then they had to put some kind of thing back in it, and they just made a mess of it.
Yeah, I can imagine that happening.
Okay. Not because they weren't good. They were good people. But because, you know, I've always, you know, put a lot more thought into the architecture of a program than the idea of writing a lot of code.
Mm-hmm.
And John, by nature, is somebody, or at least was at the time I knew him, that his view was, you know, the most common statement, they're going to put us out of business tomorrow. They're going to put us out of business tomorrow. You know, we're doomed if we don't ship. And so everything was like, you know, shoved in. And see, John could crank out 1,000 lines of code instantly. Okay, just blink your eye and bang, it's there. But it was spaghetti code. It had no architecture. He never did seem to exhibit a sense of structure. Okay. He was a genius, but it was like dyslexia. He thought too fast for his fingertips.
This is maybe one of the explanations of why later he supported Ted Nelson and the Xanadu effort at Autodesk.
No, I think it's because he was smart enough to see that there's genuine genius there.
Genuine genius there.
Okay. John is a very, or, you know, like I say, I'll say past tense because I knew him then and I don't know him now. Okay. I don't know what kind of a person he is today.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a big gap in between. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was an exceedingly smart individual. I mean, he was fascinating to listen to because he read everything. His mind was all over the map. You know, he had much to commend him. And it was stimulating visiting and talking with him. Okay? I mean, he kind of went nutso when the business got too big. He didn't handle stress very well. Okay, he tried too hard to keep everything under his own control.
When did they start growing? When did Autodesk start to really grow?
82.
Okay, here's what happened. In 82, we released the product. Okay, and it's out there and it's selling. We got Mike Ford, a guy who ran the local computer store in Mill Valley or Sausalito, to be our marketing type. In my opinion, you know. While every person in that company in the early days contributed mightily, there were three people who were essential. Mm-hmm. If you'd removed any one of them, it wouldn't have worked.
Wouldn't have worked at all.
If you'd removed me, it wouldn't have worked. If you'd removed John Walker, it wouldn't have worked. And if you'd removed Mike Ford, it wouldn't have worked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, this is not in any way to denigrate everybody else's contribution. People
Lyons,
working like crazy.
Was Eric Lyons there at that time?
Huh?
Eric Lyons at that
time? Eric Lyons came later.
Later.
He wasn't one of the founders. Okay. But for different reasons. Now, John's big accomplishment, the thing for which I think, you know, he deserves a masterpiece recognition, is not an act of programming, and that's what he wanted to be recognized for.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
John's bit of genius was that he managed to take 18 totally undisciplined programmers and manage it, corral it into a business that actually worked and made money and grew. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is no small feat. In the world, that is a very admired thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, very few people could have managed that. I certainly could not have managed that. I was a flake. Okay, so that was John's real skill. The problem was when the business grew beyond his ability to do that, he didn't really know how to let go. He tried to micromanage everything, and it kind of drove people nuts. But his stresses got the better of him, and it almost obsessed him. But you know, if they'd have had a little Xanax or something back then, I think everything would have been great. You know, I handled stress pretty well because basically, when I hit a certain level of stress, I just dump it and I ignore it. Just like, fuck it, don't apply.
Right.
Well, this pissed everybody else off, mind you, because I would refuse to get in a blather to hurry to get something done. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there were a lot of the usual, it was almost like a little rock band, you know, the sort of infighting and shit.
Mm-hmm. So,
but,
as you move to the 286, the processor kind of caught up with the...
Well, see, you know, the thing is, you know, by the time you're going to really get there, build the market, get the recognition, the machines will catch up.
Yeah.
But what happened was this, you know, we go out, we show it, got a lot of buzz from, you know, a lot of people going, wow, this is like, you know, space stuff. You know, I had no clue a PC could do this. But we didn't have a lot of buyers. But we had a, we had enough to sort of keep doors open, you know, keep us from going under.
Because you had no investors.
Huh?
The company didn't have investors.
See, we did something very, very weird. And I'm not sure if John's responsible for this or me or the both of us talking together. There were things on which we agreed right down the line. And one was that you bring in outside investors, they take too much control. Okay, and what we did initially was we put the company together with sweat equity. Basically, everybody threw in $3,000. John had about 60 from selling his Marinchip systems. Not selling it, but from his business that he put in. So he put up the lion's share of cash and thus became the guy who got to ride the pony. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of us worked for a couple years with no money. Hmm. Okay. Hmm. We kept our day jobs and we worked, mm-hmm. and that was our sweat equity. And I, you know, the company went public in '85, and then we had all kinds of, you know, they had all kinds of money. By then, I'd left the company. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, as I mentioned, in '81, '82, somewhere in that time frame.
Yeah. And so what happened, see, was in January of 1984, Byte Magazine published an article in which they talked about PCCAD and mentioned the three competing programs. There was AutoCAD, VersaCAD, and I forget what the third one was. It was not a bad program. It went on to be a pretty good CAD something or other.
Was it generic CAD or no?
No, that's later.
CAD.
What was that guy down in San Diego, architecture professor, StarCAD?
No. But there was a third one. Now, VersaCAD grew out of the UCSD Pascal stuff.
Yeah, it was Tom Lazier's stuff.
Well, actually, it was Mike Lazier's stuff that Tom stole credit for.
Okay.
Let's be honest.
All right.
Tom Lazier never wrote a line of code in his
That's
life.
That's true. You're right. He was
okay. I mean, this one bothers me because his son and I got along great.
Yeah.
Cooperated fully, loved each other, and Tom screwed me as much as he could.
Okay. Well, he got it back a few times in his life, so.
What?
He got it back a few times in his life, too, so.
Well, not because anybody tried to, you know. I tried to be real graceful about it. Basically, I just scared him.
Yeah.
So, when this hit, all of a sudden, the program was credible. If there was competition and somebody picked the best,
right,
then now it's safe to get involved. And sales just went schwam.
Wow.
And it has never looked back. Because, mm-hmm. see, right about then, the machines were getting fast enough.
Yeah.
Now,
in 84, you had the AT was just about out the door.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the XT was out there, and the AT was out there.
Yeah. I saw the
ASU-IBM project. And we had those IBM PC1s and 2s and then the XTs. And we were the first institution to negotiate a site license
for
Autodesk, for the software.
Well, I worked at IBM Thomas Watson Research Center as a research student, and we had ATs with wires hanging out. They were prototypes called Big Top, mm-hmm. and we used to carry them on the airplane in a special box. It was a weird shape because you carry them between labs, and they were the AT machine. It was the summer of '84,
mm-hmm.
just about out.
It was amazing how many phone calls and visits we had
from
industry and other institutions. As we set up the lab, IBM donated all the computer systems. We put them in computer labs.
Well, the interesting thing was that the PC got away from them, you know.
Yeah.
Sure did.
That whole
famous
story.
I'm really glad it did, you know, but Don
Massaro?
No, Estridge or...
Don Estridge,
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy in IBM who basically pushed this through.
And Bill
Because
Lowe.
They figured it would make a nice replacement smart terminal for data entry. They never saw it as eating their lunch, you know?
Now they're completely out of business.
Well, you know, actually, IBM is leaner, meaner, and a much better corporation now.
Yeah.
Okay? But, you know, they've been smart enough to grow with the times rather than fight them. And I got to hand it to them. Their management has behaved in a impeccable manner. You know, for a company that large, they used to be famous for monopoly abuse.
Yeah.
You know, lately I've seen nothing but intelligent, you know, community acceptable behavior from them. Like all this patent pool they're donating for open source use and stuff.
Wonderful, yeah.
I mean, you know, that people haven't realized what a big step that is. Mm-hmm. We might actually be able to continue to innovate if somebody can beat what's been happening with IP lately. Because mm-hmm. I've been very perturbed.
Well, Bruce has been working with open source.
Yeah.
And, you know, the world's been run by the lawyers long enough. Let them take a vacation. They earned it. Mm-hmm. By stealing, but they earned it.
Mm-hmm. So you left in 84 or in 85?
I left right around then.
Yeah.
Arguments between John and I, basically. At one meeting, he basically said, you know, I was telling him how they were bitching about how they were having a problem with some aspect of the program.
The program, yeah.
And I said, well, this is how I solved it in Interact. And he says, I don't want to hear about Interact. I want to hear another word from you about CAD. You have nothing to do with CAD. You have nothing to say about CAD. We don't want to hear a damn thing you have to say. You understand? Just shut the fuck up and take your money.
And it all came back to that.
He did this
agreement
in front of everybody.
Oh, man.
And I said, okay, John, I get the point. You'll regret this. And I walked out. Mm-hmm. And, see, one of the things he didn't realize is that pretty much everybody, even though I'm way down here, would call me up to go fight their fights with John, mm-hmm. and I act as a sort of a civilizing influence between them all, and it wound up taking an awful lot of my time, and so we parted company, and I said, okay, they took a program that when I started with it was $500, and every time they turned around, they raised it another $500, because he wanted it to be $3,000 to $4,000, and I said, you know, there's just a lot of people who are never going to afford $3,000 to $4,000. And not wanting to hurt AutoCAD, because someday I was going to make money on it, I got my first royalty check, I think, in about 84. And, you know, I made a great deal of money off it. And so I went out and I decided I was going to make a littler CAD program. And I said, get back to a cheap price point everybody can afford. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I made EasyCAD. I had done some work with the Apple Macintosh, and the Mac wasn't there yet in terms of having the resources to put CAD on.
But processor was good, but perhaps the other elements.
The what?
The processor was probably
the processor was acceptable.
Yeah.
Acceptable only. But the amount of memory was impossible.
Yeah. And okay. the threading models and things like that.
Well, I didn't mind that. To tell you the truth, none of these programs have been multi-threaded yet. AutoCAD to this day isn't. Okay. Well, if you think about what's going on, I mean, you know, only now when we start having, when you're running the CPU at 100% load, what is the point of putting in the overhead of multi-threading? Okay. Okay. You have to have unused CPU cycles for threading to be of benefit.
Right. And it's a declining curve.
And it just, you know, it's only now as we start to see dual core and hyper-threading and so on, that it actually makes sense. Okay? And I'll bet you, when I'm currently at work on something that does this in CAD, and so far my measurements are it'll give about a 5% benefit. But it's a starting point down the next curve.
Right, when the
you know, because that's where Intel's going is to have,
instead
of speeding up the CPU, they're giving multiples, so it's now time to be working on that direction.
Right.
Okay. See, I do a very unusual thing. I actually analyze where I'm going before I go there. Mm-hmm. That's not common in our business.
It goes all the way back to the S100 system. Yeah.
You know, to give you an idea, what John wanted to port it to, he wanted to put it on the Intel 432. Well, it looked on paper to be an incredible machine. Okay, it was designed so you could just plug in however many CPUs you wanted along a sort of a CPU bus and have all the crunch power you needed. Okay, and so he said, that's, you know, CAD is crunch oriented, you know, and, you know, this looks like a pretty damn good thing. And, you know, my argument was, you're absolutely right, it'd be a far better processor for CAD. However, you're absolutely wrong. Wherever IBM goes, you go. If they're going to do it, that's going to be what everybody buys.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John thought about it and decided, okay, that argument trumped it. And so we put it on the much poorer processor. And I'm glad.
So okay. when 386 came out, and I mean, programs like CAD really have taken advantage of the instruction set, and when everybody else wasn't.
Well, we really learned to push the envelope, but there is a little further part of the story where that happens. So as EasyCAD happens, I come out with this program. It had been based on what I learned from the Macintosh.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. The Macintosh turned the whole program architecture upside down. It was event-driven, and it made life easy on the user by making life hard for the programmer.
Hard on the developer, yeah.
Okay, but you have one time you write the program, and you've got, if you're lucky, many, many thousands or even millions of people out there going to be users. So that was an entirely good balance of load. And it was an eye-opener for me. So I wrote a program that, from day one, used Windows icons, dialog boxes, and elements like that that I'd seen in the Mac. I just had to write them all myself.
Right. And I did that myself in the 80s. I'll tell you about that later.
It'll be interesting. I've always been interested in UI.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And when I wrote this program, I violated all the traditional waterfall structure rules. I didn't have a spec. I didn't have a damn thing. What I did was I wrote a program, and about once a month I would put it in front of a few people.
Yeah.
And I'd give them a task and no instruction. I would say, here's a drawing. Make this drawing on the computer. And then I would stand behind them with a clipboard, taking notes on how they guessed, and what they tried, and what
testing,
gave them, shit. And I had a friend of mine in the other room with a little hardwired phone whenever they felt they had to call tech support. And I told them, there was literally, at the end of the day, $100 minus $5 for every time they picked up the phone.
Mm.
Okay. So there would be a cost involved.
Okay.
And so, and then he kept logs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we would compare what I saw had actually been happening and how they explained it and how tech support heard it.
Yeah. Was that John?
Huh?
John Steen?
No, that wasn't John Steen. That was Dan Corrigan.
Okay.
And John Steen came along about a year later in the process. And I did this iteratively every month for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got done, I had a program that worked a whole lot more like what people thought about. It didn't work anything like what I would have set out to do. Because, see, when I did AutoCAD, or when I did Interact, which became AutoCAD to be much more accurate, I paid no attention whatsoever to ease of use. I was so far up against the wall about this is really fucking impossible.
Right.
That as far as I was concerned, I'd deal with that later when the processors got a little better. Okay? It didn't use a mice because mice didn't exist.
Yeah.
You got to put it in a historical perspective.
Except at Xerox PARC, if you could get hold of
something like that. No, in 79, they did not exist even at Xerox PARC. I talked to the guy who invented the mouse.
Really using a joystick.
Huh?
Graphics words, like a joystick.
Yeah, but us poor people never saw such a thing back then.
Right.
And, the best graphics display available is 480 by 640 black and white, no grayscale. Mm-hmm. Or 320 by 200 four color. Mm-hmm. For putrid looking colors, I might add. It was black, white, magenta, and a six sort of green. Those were the only colors you had.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
Do you have any of the original Interact systems left? I mean, any of the cases?
I've got in storage a machine that I hand built that takes it and runs the ship on an 8-inch floppy, and I will one of these days bring it out, fire it up, and see if I can get the thing working again.
If you know of anybody else who might have one in storage that is going to toss it, let me know.
I'll see what I can come up with.
You're going to have to explore the museum, isn't he? He's going to have to pay you a visit, too.
And it's all online, too. It's like 50,000 objects on the site now.
Okay.
It's a bottom-up telling of the whole story of personal computing.
I'll see if I can't fill in a couple holes here for you. So EasyCAD comes out, right? And I'm getting fought seriously by my own dealership. They're all sitting practically threatening me when I told them I was going to sell it for $200. They depend on a higher price because they don't have enough customers. So we agree on a sort of a happy hunting ground value of about $500 a copy. So it comes out at $500. They're still unhappy. As several of them told me, look, for about the same amount of time and effort, I can sell a copy of EasyCAD or a copy of FastCAD. If I sell, I can sell AutoCAD and get $3,000, or I can sell EasyCAD and get $500. And from my perspective, there's very little difference in the amount of work I have to do. And I says, yes, but you don't have any work to support it. It supports itself. And he says, and that's another problem, because I make my money on training, and I've never needed to train anybody on EasyCAD. Because basically within a week or two, they were up and running. In 20-some years of business, we never, ever were able to run a training seminar. Every time we tried one, schedule it, people would sign up for it, but you have to do that in enough advance to build a class. And, you know, everybody would call up a week or two later and cancel. And up until the latest version of FastCAD, we were running 90% update rates. So I know it was being used.
You had a good user form, though.
Well, from the very beginning, I was very user-centric.
Yeah.
It was the thing that set me apart from Autodesk. You know, they took a very imperious, you will behave attitude towards their customers. And I took a "we're your buddy" attitude. I quite literally told the people who worked for me, their job was to work for the customers, and I was the enemy. You know, you take their side, you be their champion. Okay, you're a gladiator, and you're to come make the evil company behave. And I had a great deal of employee loyalty too, because people could believe in what they were doing.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we go to Comdex and we release this, the people I picked to market EasyCAD...
Would have been about 86, 87? Or?
No, this was Comdex 85, end of 85.
85, okay.
Well, that was same fast. Year. That same
was fast.
Year,
that was very fast.
I'm a very fast programmer.
It's impressive.
Same year...
Two reasons why I had FastCAD. EasyCAD first.
Okay.
Back to that later.
Okay.
Same year that...
Okay. Yeah. So we come out with EasyCAD... There, I made the deal with Tom Lazier and VersaCAD to sell it, and I told him, I says, look, you're absolutely certain you're not going to be bent about not invented here. And I says, I want you to double and triple check this, because the big problem I felt I had done in the deal with AutoCAD was I hadn't kept creative control of the product, and it had gone in ways that I just found aberrant. Okay, I couldn't get John to listen to me. In 3 years, about the only new thing in the product, you know, drivers. That's it. You know, the quote ADE extensions, which were ways I later found out to try and screw me out of my royalties, that wound up costing them about $12 million.
That original letter, that agreement in, what, 79, 80?
Yeah, as the lawyers told them, don't fight this shit.
And that letter sort of held. That writing.
Well. You know, I mean, in truth, though I have my differences with John, and he did things that really pissed me off right about the time period I'm talking about, you know, John was never somebody who intended to be a dishonorable man. He just absolutely felt, not in over his head, but definitely like he was swimming with sharks. Okay, the watching the company go public, it was just insane.
Yeah.
You know, it became, for every dollar you could make programming, you could make $100 spending time with lawyers and accountants. And that just drove people nuts. Drove me nuts, but it especially stressed the fuck out of John.
That's what happened in Apple's public offering. Got a whole bunch of stories about that.
Yeah,
people went crazy trying to get more stock. That's all they were focused on.
Well, this wasn't that. I mean... The people in the company, there wasn't a whole lot of infighting or anything. The argument tended to be between John and me at this point. Because, you know, I kept saying, like, the agreement of where I parted company is I walked in with associative hatching. You change the shape and the hatching adjusts to it. And John's statement was, it takes us 12 hours to link this. every time we change it. We're not going to add new entities. We've got this new thing we added to group them for the transform, and so you will make your hatching put however many zillions of lines in there. And I said, no. I just said, no. CAD is about intelligent entities. I says, you're missing the whole point of it. I says, what we've got now is a toy. We've got to grow beyond it. I says, John, you need to understand, we either obsolete our own product or somebody else will. I says, you know, we should be working on what's going to eat our lunch.
Yeah.
We should be the people who come out with it. Mm-hmm. And we've got to get past here. He says, no, it's, you know, I've got 17 people scattered all over the Bay Area, and anytime you do something like this in a new entity, it affects every single module as they have to put the hooks in. And the 12 hours doing the link, because see, they didn't have any, every driver had to be like a, what did they call them then? Overlays. Mm-hmm. Okay,
yeah.
That would fly in and
out. Oh, right.
So yeah. As they added driver support, the link build just got horrible.
And of course,
because this is back in DOS days, there was no system windows, there was no graphic support, so we did all drivers.
And strangely enough, there's no network, so people literally drove around to link the drivers.
They well, there was a very primitive network that among the Bay Area.
So they could put it on a BDS or something.
Well, they got everybody on a Berkeley email system but me, because I live down here. So when John later writes a book about AutoCAD, I'm hardly in it, and he acts like that, you know, I had almost nothing to do with it, because he just, as his thing, he points to the emails. This is the log of the emails, and that just very handily cut me right out. Mm-hmm. An awful lot of other people set the record straight. But see, John used the part where I said in the original contract, you don't give out my name and address, because I wanted him to do his own tech support. To mean that you tell everybody you wrote it, which is what he did. And when the company went public, he failed to disclose that he had this commitment to pay me royalties. And it was sizably millions of dollars. So, wow. So he moves to Switzerland all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He goes berserk. And his lawyers all just, they threaten me with all kinds of crap.
Because of his non-disclosure.
Well, I didn't know that at the time, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm extrapolating some, but, you know, he definitely did not disclose it, okay? See, they went public and announced it at the same time we're at Comdex. All this shit's happening at the same time.
Wow, Comdex,
okay? And so he's telling the stock analyst that, you know, and they say, well, what about this new program by the guy who wrote it? And he says, there is no guy who wrote it. I wrote it. And he says, well, he's over in booth such and such showing it.
Yeah.
So they come over to the VersaCAD booth, his mortal enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm there selling a new program.
Mm-hmm.
So we go and we have a powwow, and he says, why didn't you bring it to us? And I says, well, John, you told me you didn't want to have anything to do with me or what I thought about CAD.
Publicly.
And he goes, well, why couldn't you just take your money and live under a rock where you came from?
Oh, my.
Okay. And I said, well, that's not me. I like CAD. It's what I do. You should have listened to me. And I said, I'll be glad to pull it from him and give it to you. And he says, what are you going to do with it? I don't think you'll sell it. He says, of course I won't. I'll pull it off the market and do a feasibility study for a few years. And I says, so what's the point? You want it not to sell, and I want it out there. And he says, it's the worst possible product at the worst possible time from the worst possible author at the worst possible price. And I said, sounds like I'm right on. And so he explained to me, he says, look, you need to understand one thing and understand it very clearly. And these were the last words he said to me before I walked out, and I've never talked to him again. He said to me, people get killed for the amount of money I write on you a check for every month or every quarter.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm. And I said, is that a threat? And he said, take it how you like. And so I walked out, and I, you know, you need to understand that I don't take threats well. I grew up in Watts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my first instinct was to go kill him before he killed me. And secondly, I thought, you know what, knowing John, he didn't mean it. You know, he was pissed,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Because true enough, he could have. That is a lot of money,
yeah.
Okay? And so I said, okay, he's blowing smoke because he's pissed and he's got a lot of stress on him. But that's definitely over the fucking line.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, okay, EasyCAD quite deliberately was designed not to threaten AutoCAD. After all, I was making a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so like for example, EasyCAD did not include dimensioning. Okay, there's a real good, it's not CAD. Okay. It's for technical illustration.
Right, right.
Okay. And you know, so I thought he'd be happy with that, but he knew damn well. And so his lawyers told me that I had signed an agreement giving the company right of first refusal and had refused to do it. And I said, but I don't work for you. And he said, yeah, but you can't prove you don't work for me. And I says, why should I have to prove I don't work for you? You should have to prove I do. He says, but you worked for many years with no money. You're making all your money off of royalties, so we'll just say that you continued to do that. Hmm. You know, to be nice to us because you were making so much more than everybody else off this other stuff. And I says, so you violated that. And I says, you know you're going to get slaughtered on that. And he goes, well, I don't know that, but we're going to do whatever we can do to put you back where you belong, which is not in this business. And his lawyers then, you know, promptly, you know, sent me a little, you know, enjoinment to stop selling this shit. Okay.
That was a comics to remember. That's amazing.
So it took about 6 months before they went to their lawyers, and I went to my lawyers, and they decided right off the bat that they damn well better fucking negotiate a way out of this shit. Okay. So after about 6 months, generic CAD comes out, and they get the credit as the first low-cost CAD. And that always, to this day, has pissed the shit out of me. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because, you know, I mean, I had a chance to, once again, be there first. And, you know, ultimately, they wound up buying generic CAD because they couldn't stuff it in the box any other way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's making all these claims that I stole all their lines of code. I mean, wait a minute, you got this shit from me. How did I steal code from you? And you don't do any of the shit I do, you know? My shit's all in SPL, and, you know, and so, anyway, they're making noises. So I said, okay, now I'm going to go after them. I'm going to do what I haven't done because he's pissed me off.
Right, right.
And I said, okay, the single worst thing about AutoCAD is its speed. So I'm going to make the fastest CAD program on the planet. That, given the hardware it runs on, it's not possible to make it faster. That was my first statement of mission statement. Okay, I'm going to use what I learned about ease of use, because that's their second weakest point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to make it modular as hell, and I'm going to solve the driver compile problem. So I invented the DLL.
Okay.
Now, I mean, it wasn't, the difference is it wasn't part of the system.
Right.
Okay,
right.
The operating system didn't support it.
Right.
But it was independently compiled modules that were linked at runtime.
Sure.
Which I consider makes it a DLL.
Of course it is, yeah.
You could fly different ones in and out for different features.
Mm-hmm. And then you made...
And I called that my XP architecture for extended programming.
And then you probably created like a user interface layer, too, to do better GUI.
Well, I'd already done that for EasyCAD, and it was a success. Mm-hmm. So I had that under my belt. So I went and I wrote a program completely in assembler from the ground up. There was not a line of anything that wasn't assembler. Okay. And it was about 40 times faster in AutoCAD. And it got faster. The ratio improved. Sure. They never got closer. It just got wider.
Every clock speed that jumped up. And
well, every new processor that came out, my shit took more advantage of it than the compilers did. Because it's an assembler. I can take advantage of it.
You can take advantage of it, yeah.
Okay. You know, like, we had some very surprising encounters with that. One of them was that there was a company named ITC who made a math coprocessor.
I remember that, yeah.
And I get, or Wytec.
Wytec.
ITC also made one. And since I had a plug-in architecture, I just made a plug-in for the floating point math.
If you found it, you loaded it, and that was it.
Yeah, it would do it, check it, and it would run one of the three. Okay? And all of the code, essentially, you know, would flip out. You know, it would
like a dynamic... You'd take out the software, and
there
it were.
You know, the interesting thing was this. It would literally go through and take and replace the code snippets everywhere. So it was like inline code. Because remember, my DLL was something I wrote, so it literally could patch anything in anywhere.
So you patched all your floating point stuff.
Yeah, so instead of making calls to, you know, they were direct calls in all cases. I mean, it worked on that level.
So you patched the instructions.
Yeah.
To take it. Oh my gosh.
See, you can't do that with a DLL.
At runtime.
Yeah, at runtime. Okay. Well, it worked great. And so it was like having native code in all cases.
See, it was like doing a compile at runtime to take advantage of the hardware you found.
Yeah. I've never been afraid of pushing the limits.
That's where Intel called you and wanted to know how the hell well, you that's what I was doing.
Well, here's the thing, see. Wayfek was eating Intel's lunch in the ads about how much faster their math processor was.
And they were using your software?
No. I mean, you know, with AutoCAD, it was much faster to use this Wayfek processor.
Mm-hmm.
Problem was, I didn't duplicate that result at all. The Intel machine always beat the Wayfek processor by a good 30%. Okay? And you know, the Wayfek people were very upset. You know, they confidently had sent me a unit and all the help I wanted and so on. And up it comes, and I says, I'm sorry, here's the actual source code. You tell me where to make it better. You know? Because it was modular, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was modularly driven. Here's the thing. You show me, you know, how to do these things better and faster. You're not getting any overhead calls, nothing. Okay?
Right. Yeah.
They've got no native advantage. The way I did it was clean as shit.
Yeah.
And
because you could give them almost like assembler for one, assembler for the other.
Well, I did. I showed them. And I says, here's the source of all of them, all three of you. And to be fair, I gave it to all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And guy from Intel calls up and he goes, I'm the guy who designs the 8087. And I want to know, how in the hell you're making it beat this machine? Because this has really bothered us. And I said, it's real simple. You're slow on load and store. You're fast on everything else. The C compilers are crap. They're doing load A, add B, store C, load C, add D, store C, you know. And I said, because of that, you're getting creamed. Because the Wayfek machine is fast on load and stores and slower on the calculations.
Right.
And I said, so here's my inner loop. Here's the four. I had a section that did the sort of floating point scaling and clipping as a block of 14 instructions all in a row.
Mm-hmm.
All floating point instructions with nothing in between.
Basically, you had made a pipeline, a small pipeline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, here's the core of this shit. I said, the rest of the stuff don't count.
Right.
You make this faster, the program goes faster. You make this slower, it goes slower. This is the critical path. And he took a look at it, and he says, well, you load it all in a register, do everything, and then store the result. And I says, damn straight. And he goes, that's all there is to it, isn't it? And I went, yeah. And he says, well, what could we do that would make it better for you? And I said, what you really need to do to make it better is this. See, I says, I've got a bunch of shit I can be doing while you're executing a floating point instruction.
Right.
Longer than any of the floating point instructions in
sure.
that pipeline.
Yeah.
It just about adds up to the time of the whole pipeline. I says, what you need to let me do is queue up or stack a bunch of instructions
loads.
For execution.
Right.
So that when I do an F wait, they're all done rather than having... See, right now I can only overlap one instruction.
This is the first multi-stage pipeline in the yep. Intel world, basically.
I don't know that. I don't know what they did with the rest of their processor.
But this is before they started
okay.
looking at pipelining.
Well, they started looking at that and they started getting two and three instruction look-aheads and they, you know... See, I'd shown the guy incontrovertibly with source code in hand, real world, how to make their machine shine.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just happier in punch.
Mm-hmm.
So he was at that time working on the early versions of the 586. Because apparently, I mean, you have to do this shit.
Yeah, they were
advanced.
Doing the generation.
So when the 586 came out, all of a sudden floating point was no longer a problem.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I remember when they sent you one, you had it in your bedroom. And you surprised me one day after I was visiting you in your lab. You said, I'm going to take a look in my bedroom at this computer by my bed.
Pentium, the first Pentium,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had people who rewarded me with goodies.
Yeah, it was treated well.
This is an amazing insight into, because I remember at that time, I remember all those floating, the math coprocessors and, what, and the software we were writing, which I'll tell you about later, we just couldn't get to it. We couldn't use it.
But see, once I bit the big banana or whatever and wrote it in an assembler, I was able to use everything. So what we did, the most effective ad I'd ever written, I used to have a plaque of it.
I'm looking for your quote on reality, Mike.